So 2 Samuel 12 is a bit of a pivotal turning point in David's life. So David at this point has committed the sin with Bathsheba. He has hidden it by having Uriah, well, he tries several different things, but ultimately it leads to having Uriah murdered by Joab. And it covered up by just simply being, well, this is part of war, because what they do is they get to a position that was dangerous, and they have everybody pull back, and Uriah ends up dying. So as we progress here, starting in chapter 12, there's a series of events that are going to unfold. I'm going to cover them somewhat quickly. In terms of, I guess, the big scheme of things, there's always that difficult thing as a teacher of how quick to go and how slow to go. And so if there's something that you have a question about, or there's something that you, in your reading, because once again, we mentioned this before, but it's always good to re-mention it. Reading this on your own will benefit you separate from the class. They can kind of combine together to be a useful thing, as opposed to just either taking a class or just reading it on your own. Hopefully the two of them work really well together. So if there's some insights from your own personal reading that you have noticed, just, you know, stop me as we go through. But David at this point has committed the sin. Uriah has died. And then it ends chapter 11 with saying the thing that David had done was evil in the sight of the Lord. So it seems to David at this point, he got away with it and it's all turned out okay. But in reality, God knows. And there's a huge lesson there in and of itself in terms of application, that there's a lot of things that we may think, oh, I snuck by without any consequences. Well, that doesn't necessarily mean that's the case. And what we'll find with David is that some of the consequences to this sin are ones that you would not have necessarily directly related. So sometimes the consequences of sins are not as easy to map as what we might think. When somebody goes out and they drink and drive, we say, well, a logical consequence of that might be getting in a car wreck. What we don't think about is somebody who is a regular drinker and the consequence being they're estranged from their children because their children grow up with a dad who's disconnected with them. That's not necessarily a consequence you would naturally connect to drinking, but that absolutely can happen. And that's what we're going to find with David, is that many of the consequences are not the ones he would have mapped out in his mind, but they are connected to this particular sin. So in chapter 12, God is going to send Nathan the prophet to David. We've seen Nathan previously. He's been part of what we would consider to be David's inner circle. And Nathan is going to come with this rebuke of David, but he's going to do it in an interesting way. He's going to do it through a parable. We often associate parables with Jesus, but Jesus is not the only one to tell parables. Nathan is going to bring David this parable that David at first is going to think is a true story. And he's going to explain there's two men, one who's rich and the other's poor. The rich man has a lot of herds and flocks. And this poor man has one lamb. And he loves this lamb and he nourishes it and he cherishes it. And it lives with his children. And it's this kind of affectionate sort of pet relationship. He talks about the animal eating of his bread and drinking of his cup and lying in his bosom. Very similar to what we might think of as like a lap dog or something like that. Family pet. And he says in verse 4, now a traveler came to the rich man and he was unwilling to take from his own flock or his own herd to prepare for the wayfarer who had come to him. Rather, he took the poor man's ewe lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to him. So he takes this other man's lamb, the one that he cherished so much, instead of one from his many, many flocks, and kills it and butchers it and serves it up to this stranger. And David, when he hears this story, is just incensed over it and says, this man is worthy of death. Which, by the way, is stronger than God's law on that subject. what he's done is he's stolen, if that were a true story, what he's done is he's stolen an animal from him. And according to God's law, he would have paid a recompense for that, but he wouldn't have died. That wasn't a capital punishment worthy offense. But David's so mad by the story that this guy would be so heartless to take the family pet and do that, that he says he has done something deserving of death because he did this thing and he had no compassion. Well, the very next verse answers Nathan to David, "You are the man. Thus says the Lord God of Israel, it is I who anointed you king over Israel, and it is I who delivered you from the hand of Saul. I also gave you your master's house and your master's wives into your care, and I gave you the house of Israel and Judah, and if that had been too little, I would have added to you many more things like these. Why have you despised the word of the Lord by doing evil in his sight? You struck down Uriah the Hittite with the sword, have taken his wife to be your wife, and have killed him with the sword of the sons of Ammon." And so he just lays out, he says, you're that guy. And you didn't do it with a lamb, you did it with a man. And the whole thing hits David full force. That is exactly what he's done. I have done this absolutely awful, wicked thing. Which, there's a lot we can take from that. One element of it is that up until this point, that tells you David's found a way somehow in his mind to not realize how bad this sin was. And we can do that. Even good people can do that, where you can commit a sin for a length of time and not really realize what you're doing or its full impact. But then when he does, his response to it in verse 13 is, David said to Nathan, "I have sinned against the Lord." And Nathan said to David, "The Lord also has taken away your sin. You shall not die. However, because by this deed you have given occasion to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme, the child also that is born to you shall surely die." So Nathan went to his house. So David has committed the sin. Nathan then confronts him with it. And David owns it. Unlike Saul, right? Saul sinned against the Lord, but every time Saul sinned, there was an excuse as to why it wasn't as big of a deal. David doesn't do any of that. No excuses. Owns, yes, I have sinned, and I've sinned against the Lord. And God forgives him. He says that you're not going to die, but there are going to be some consequences for it. The first of those consequences is the death of the child. The second of it is going to be, well, some of these I'm realizing may be a little bit out of order here. But the second one he mentions in verse 10, "Now therefore, because you have despised me and have taken the wife of, now therefore the sword shall never depart from your house because you have despised me and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife." The second thing is not only does the child die, but that his family, his household will forever be facing the consequences of this. There's going to be war and fighting within his own household for the rest of David's life. And we'll see all of that play out. Anybody have any questions on that or any insight or comments? Okay, so then David is told all of this, and it says Nathan went to his house. Another character difference that we might mention about David versus Saul is when Samuel told Saul things he didn't want to hear, Samuel then worried for his own life. And he was afraid. Nathan doesn't have that problem. He seems to just go home, and we'll see him interacting with David again, that David won't kill the messenger. So there's another character difference. And so then, starting in verse 15, the Lord, it says, struck the child that Uriah's widow bore to David so that he was very sick. So the child becomes very sick. And David is going to pray to God for the child. He's going to fast. He's going to lay all night on the ground and in every way show his level of despondency and sadness and over this event. And then a very strange thing will happen on the seventh day the child's going to die. All of his servants are afraid to talk to him about it, because if he was so sad while the child was sick, the expectation is that once the child dies, it'll be too much for David. And they're afraid for his own life and how he'll take the news. But David, seeing them essentially whispering together, figures out, hey, is the child dead? And then it says in verse 20, David arose from the ground. He washed, he anointed himself, he changed his clothes, and he went into the house of the Lord and worshiped. And then he came to his own house, and he requested they set food before him, and he ate. So he just then goes about his own business, and now it's kind of the servants go the other direction. They say, well, wait a second, the child died. Why are you acting like this? And his answer to them is a very good lesson to us, that in verse 22, he says, while the child was still alive, I fasted and wept, for I said, who knows, the Lord may be gracious to me that the child may live, but now he has died. Why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I will go to him, but he will not return to me. So David's response is essentially, I prayed that God would save the child, and I didn't know what God's answer would be until the child died. Once the child died, now I know what God's will is. And I will accept that, and now I have one job. The child has died. What's my one job now? I'm going to go to him, right? My job is to live the right way so that I can go to be with that child. And so this is a good lesson here in what does it really mean to pray if the Lord wills, we'll do this or that. You know, we're told in the New Testament that whatever we pray, we should pray with in mind that the Lord's will should be done. There's a time where you don't know things, and you can pray not knowing the answer, but then there's a point where sometimes that answer comes, and it's not the one you expected, and the answer then is, okay, that's God's will. And so there's got to be a reason for it, and I need to move forward, and that's an act of faith. And so that's what David will do at this point. And so that's one thing to remember. Another important lesson that we can learn, there's actually quite a few things that we can learn from the death of this child. Another one is when he says, I will go to him, what's the implication? Where does David think that the child is? Child's in heaven. There's a great verse to use for with people who believe that you're born in sin. Because if you are born in sin, the Bible says the wages of sin are death, spiritual death. So then, and it's not quite popular today in America to teach this, but it is an implication of being born in sin. And they did used to teach it much more commonly, even 20, 25 years ago. I mean, I remember growing up sitting in churches and they were teaching this still openly from the pulpit. So it's not that long ago. That it was more common to say, yeah, children that weren't baptized as infants and things like that, they go to hell. Well, this is an indictment of that. David very clearly said, this child, it goes to heaven, and then it's my job to go to it. Children are innocent, they're born innocent, and they get a free pass because that's the kind of God that we have. The other thing that this tells us is sometimes we wonder about why innocent people suffer. I mean, this child is sick. What has the child done wrong? Absolutely nothing at all. Well, why do innocent people suffer? The answer is sin, but is it always your sin? No. I mean, you look at something like an earthquake or, let's talk about something even simpler. If you go out and pick blackberries and you scratch yourself on a thorn, why did you scratch yourself on that thorn? You did what? Well, that's fair. You might be careless. But why is that thorn there in the first place? Whose sin led to thorns? We go all the way back to Adam, right? Adam is the cause of thorns. So why do people scratch themselves on thorns? Sin. But not necessarily their sin. It may be you can trace it back to Adam. Although I'm with Krista, sometimes you might be careless too. Maybe that as well. Maybe a combination deal. Here's a practical example of an innocent person. Nobody gets more innocent than a baby suffering. but not for anything that they had done wrong. And the same is true for us. There's going to be times where you suffer. Peter talks about it. And he says, you can suffer as wages for sin, as the wages of doing wrong, or sometimes you can suffer for doing good. Well, why do we suffer for doing good? Will you suffer for doing good in heaven? No, but here you do because people don't like good. There are people who are at battle with good. So it just goes to show that suffering is caused by sin, but not always your own personal sin. Then after that, in verse 24, it will talk very briefly about the birth of Solomon, who is also the child of Bathsheba. Verse 24 says, David comforted his wife Bathsheba and went into her and lay with her, and she gave birth to a son, and he named him Solomon. And now the Lord loved him and sent word through Nathan the prophet and named him Jedidiah for the Lord's sake. So that's a less well-known name of Solomon is Jedidiah, which means beloved of God. Might mention there in verse 24, just another small detail, is David comforted Bathsheba, who's another person who has suffered with all of these events, right? It wasn't just David's child that died. It was Bathsheba's too. Then through the rest of the chapter, it will mention them going back out to war with Ammon. There will be more battles. It will also mention that David is out there battling this time, as opposed to what we saw in chapter 11 when the time came to go out to war. Where was David last time? Yeah, he stayed home. He's learned that lesson, apparently, because here in chapter 12, he goes out to war with Joab and ends up having victory in that particular battle. Then we move to chapter 13. Anybody have anything there on chapter 12 before we press forward? Yes.
Was there ever, or has anybody mentioned that maybe also with this David's child dying, mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. No, I think you're right. I think that's exactly correct. Is, you know, here you have this child, and David didn't want the child to die. He prayed fervently. And then you just see, well, okay, I prayed and prayed and prayed, and yet it happened. And so David's reaction is one of I guess you would put it this way. David was comforted in knowing that even though it wasn't what he had wanted, it was what God wanted, and it was okay. And so, yeah, I think that is an example of how we should react in faith to things not turning out the way we expect, which is a pretty common thing to happen in life. I mean, most of us, I think, have things happen on at least a semi-regular basis that weren't the way we wished they would be, you know? Yeah, I think you're right. I think that is a good example of that. Then chapter 13, anybody have anything else? Okay, so then chapter 13, we're going to have this pretty horrible series of events. The Bible records things that are difficult, and here in chapter 13 is a very real example of that. David has multiple children. One of them is a young man named Absalom, and then another is named Tamar, and another Amnon. Now, these are Absalom and Amnon are Absalom and Tamar are brother and sister from the same mother. Amnon is a brother, but from a different mother. So they're all David's children, but David has multiple wives. And Amnon decides that he loves Tamar. Now, this would have been completely inappropriate against God's law for Amnon to have Tamar. And I have no doubt that Amnon knew that. I mean, in verse 2, it says, Amnon was so frustrated because of his sister Tamar that he made himself ill, for she was a virgin, and it seemed hard to Amnon to do anything to her. Amnon knew this is not a woman that he was free to marry. I imagine as the king's son, he would have had many options of women that he could have married. Tamar was not going to be one of them that he would have had that sort of freedom with. But he's just set his mind on her. And eventually, he pretends to be sick, calls and asks Tamar to come in and feed him or care for him. And Tamar, when she comes in, Amnon will grab her and he will rape her. And down in verse 14, it says, however, he would not listen to her. She's going to beg that he not do this. He did not listen to her since he was stronger than she, and he violated her and lay with her. So this is just a horrible story. It is recorded because it happened, certainly not because God is okay with it. You notice even in verse 14, how does the Bible describe this rape? It refers to it as a violation, right? She had rights. She deserved better, but he violated her. And then in verse 15, it says, Amnon hated her with a very great hatred, for the hatred with which he hated her was greater than the love with which he had loved her. This is one of those things where Amnon really didn't see her as a person, would be the way I would put it. He had objectified her. He wanted her. And then once he had her, he didn't like what it said about him that he had done that. And so now the object that he loved now became the object that he hated. None of this is godly. And so Amnon's going to send her away, having ruined her life. Certainly, it has been the case in, I think, all societies where rape is a shameful thing, though it's not the woman's fault. It is certainly at that time, I think, in particular, if a woman had been violated and then now there's the consequences of that, that it's likely that not any man is going to be interested in marrying her. And so that's a huge consequence that she would have had to deal with. So he has done everything to ruin her life for his own sensuality and depravity. And so she goes out mourning. And as she goes out crying and mourning, in verse 20, she's going to run across her brother Absalom. So we have Amnon, that is this brother that has raped her. But Absalom is her brother, and they share the same mother. So there's a much tighter bond there. And when she runs into Absalom, her brother said to her, has Amnon, your brother, been with you? But now keep silent, my sister. He is your brother. Do not take this matter to heart. So Tamar remained and was desolate in her brother Absalom's house. So Absalom's going to tell her to be quiet. What we're going to find is that he's going to tell her to be quiet because and he's going to make it sound like, look, he's your brother, just be quiet about it. Don't take it to heart. In reality, Absalom's going to take it to heart. And he's going to strike out with vengeance eventually against Amnon, but he's going to wait for the right moment. So he tells Tamar, just quiet down. He then takes her into his house. He cares for her. It says she remains desolate, that is, unmarried. And then it says in verse 21, when King David heard of all these matters, he was very angry, but Absalom did not speak to Amnon either good or bad, for Absalom hated Amnon because he had violated his sister Tamar. Now it came about after 2 full years that Absalom had sheep shearers, and we're going to see this event with Absalom and Amnon after 2 years, but pause for a second. David heard of these events, and what does it say happened with David? He's very angry. What did David do, though? Nothing. 2 years have gone by, and what's happened to Amnon? Nothing. What should have happened to Amnon according to law? Should have been put to death. what we're seeing here is these series of events that happen, and you can see why David does the things he does, and you can see why it turns out the way it does, but it's a mess. The whole thing's a giant mess, and it all comes down to what has God said would not depart from David's household? A sword's not going to depart. But if you're David and you're following the law says what should happen to a man if he rapes his sister and she cries out, which, by the way, it specifically says the law said if she's in the city and she cries out and she's heard, that the man's put to death and she's fine. Well, she does exactly that. She follows exactly what the law said a woman should do if a man forces himself upon her. She cries out. She's heard all of these things. The law said he should have been put to death. I suspect, now when I say things like I suspect, you have to understand, I can't give you a verse for it. This is my guess at what David was thinking is, had David done something similar? And David was alive. So how can I bring myself to put my son to death for something when I did basically the same thing? I suspect that's why David, though he was very angry, he knew it was wrong, didn't take that extra step of punishment. That, and also, Amnon's his son, and it's much harder to stand by the truth when it's your own kid. I mean, that's just the essence of it. You can be a good man and be blind to your own family, and that happens. That Amnon could have?
Yeah.
Well, if he had, then the next story wouldn't make sense, because he would have to stay there until the high priest died. And we know the high priest doesn't, because we know who the high priest is. And the next story, which is where Absalom actually kills Amnon, spoiler alert, right. Well, if he went there for 2 years, he, one, it's never recorded that he did. And two, he left it for a party, which he wouldn't. I mean, if you're taking that law seriously, you would have stayed in the city of refuge. So I doubt that's the case, because of those details that the high priest doesn't die, which would have freed him to come back from the city of refuge. And also that Absalom's going to call this party of the king's sons, and Amnon will come. If he was staying in a city of refuge, he wouldn't have come. So, yeah. It's an excellent point. Yes. So, yeah. Good point. Good point. So, city of refuge. The way that law worked is, if you accidentally killed somebody, you'd flee to city of refuge, but you'd still have your day in court. So they'd come, and if it was not unintentional, which this one wasn't, it was very intentional, you would have still been put to death. So that's a good point. And think about that. So there's another one on top of it. Yeah. Yeah. Good point. So Absalom, after the course of 2 years, is going to have the shearing of his sheep in Baal Hazor, which is near Ephraim, and he's going to invite all the king's sons. Well, he's going to invite them all. And then in verse 28, he's going to command his servants. It says, Absalom commanded his servants, saying, "See now, when Amnon's heart is merry with wine, and when I say to you, strike Amnon, then put him to death. Do not fear. Have not I myself commanded you? Be courageous and be valiant." And the servants of Absalom did to Amnon just as Absalom had commanded them. Then all the king's sons arose, and each mounted his mule and fled. So he has this party, invites all the king's sons. They all come, and he uses that as a chance to murder Amnon. Now, what Absalom does is still murder, because it's not a day in court, right? David could have gone about the court process and giving him a proper trial. Absalom doesn't do that. Absalom takes vengeance. And so Absalom strikes him down. And he has planned this. And when the word comes to David, what David initially hears is that Absalom's killed all of the king's sons. But Jonadab, the son of Shemaiah, David's brother, responds in verse 32, "Do not let my lord suppose they put to death all the young men, the king's sons, for Amnon alone is dead. Because by the intent of Absalom, this has been determined since the day that he violated his sister Tamar. Now therefore, do not let my lord the king take the report to heart, namely all the king's sons are dead, for only Amnon is dead." Jonadab is able to have enough wisdom to go, "No, I know what happened there. He didn't kill them all. Absalom's not that kind of guy. He just killed this one, and he's been plotting this." And sure enough, that is exactly how it works. And then in verse 34, Absalom is going to flee. So Absalom's going to run, leave the country, it will be that in verse 38, it says Absalom had fled and gone to Geshur and was there 3 years. So at this point, we've had 5 years since the events with Amnon and Tamar. And it says, verse 39, "The heart of King David longed to go out to Absalom, for he was comforted concerning Amnon since he was dead." So David kind of can close the book on Amnon. This is how this has played out. And there's some comfort in the mourning over that son. But Absalom's still out there. He's alive, and he's now a fugitive because of what he did. Anybody have any questions or thoughts or anything on chapter 13? Okay, so the next thing that happens in... I knew that one was out of sync. Okay, the next thing that's going to happen in chapter 14 is Joab, who we've seen in the past, is kind of a mixed bag. he's the guy that he's David's general. He's in charge of his mighty men. He's a really impressive military man. But he also assassinated Abner against David's wishes. He's David's nephew, so there's that family connection there. And David now has this other kind of ugly connection with Joab, in that when David wanted to have Uriah put to death, who did he enlist? It was Joab, right? So Joab was the guy who did that. So Joab's kind of this interesting person in David's life. Well, Joab sees that the king's heart is inclined toward Absalom, and Joab is going to set up this opportunity to sway David. And so what he's going to do, and I'm going to summarize a big chunk of chapter 14 here, and if there's something specific you have a question on, certainly, you know, say, "Hey, what about this particular verse?" So, because I'm definitely summarizing here. Joab is going to send a woman to tell him a story. Pretend that you're mourning the loss of your son. And what she's going to do is tell this story. And in verse 5 it says, "Truly I am a widow, for my husband is dead. Your maidservant had two sons, but two of them struggled together in the field, and there was no one to separate them. So one struck the other and killed him. Behold, the whole family has risen against your maidservant. They say, 'Hand over the one who struck his brother, that we may put him to death for the life of his brother whom he killed, and destroy the heir also.'" So she tells the story of, "My husband's dead, and I have two sons, and they were fighting one day, and one killed the other one, and now everybody in the town says, 'Hand over your one last living son, because he should be put to death for killing him.' And I'm just so sad as mom, because then I will be left all alone." So this story appeals to David's heart, and he says, "Well, look, I'll take care of it, and we'll make sure that your son doesn't have to die." And then she, once he agrees to that, she says, "I have one other thing to tell you. We're really not talking about me, we're talking about you, because what you're saying, you'll take care of my son, but you won't take care of your son Absalom, because it's the exact same circumstance." And so she's connecting these two, because Absalom and Amnon had been fighting, and Absalom had killed Amnon, and now Absalom is now banished. And so she's saying, "Hey, if that's what you do for mine, why won't you do it for yours?" David then, after hearing this and seemingly agreeing with her, asks the question, "Was Joab the person who set you up to this? Did Joab send you?" Which tells you something, David, there's more to this story that that David would go, I bet you Joab sent this woman to do this. And she says, yes, indeed, he did. In the end of it, in verse 20, she will, in answer to David's question about Joab, say, in order to change the appearance of things, your servant Joab has done this thing. But my Lord is wise, like the wisdom of the angel of God, to know all that is in the earth. So she says, yes, that's Joab did tell me to do this, and he did it so you would see things differently. So David will end up recalling Absalom. He will he'll bring him back, and Absalom will now be allowed to live in Israel again in a way that he hadn't been since he'd been banished. So in verse 23, Joab arose and went to Geshur and brought Absalom to Jerusalem. However, the king said, let him turn to his own house and let him not see my face. So first thing is, he can come here, he can come to Jerusalem, but I'm not going to see him. And then in verse 25, it'll say, in all Israel was no one as handsome as Absalom, so highly praised. From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no defect in him. And when he cut the hair of his head, it was at the end of every year that he cut it, for it was heavy on him, so he cut it. He weighed the hair of his head at 200 shekels by the king's weight. I don't remember the exact weight of it. It was some stupidly big number, like 10 pounds or something. If somebody has a quick way to Google conversion 200 shekels by weight, feel free to do that. But what we find is that Absalom's back in town. He's in there, and he's beloved by the people. The people like him. They say, "This is boy. Look, he's handsome. He's praised by all. Everybody likes him." But David won't see him. Well, after another 2 years in Jerusalem, Absalom, still having not seen his father, it says, Absalom, in verse 29, sent for Joab to send him to the king, but he would not come to him. So he sent again a second time, but he would not come. Therefore, he said to his servants, see, Joab's field is next to mine, and he has barley there. Go and set it on fire. So Absalom's servants set the field on fire. And Joab arose, came to Absalom in his house, and said to him, why have your servants set my field on fire? And Absalom answered Joab, behold, I sent for you, saying, come here, that I may send you to the king to say, why have I come from Geshur? It would be better for me to still be there. Now, therefore, let me see the king's face, and if there's iniquity in me, let him put me to death. So when Joab came to the king and told him, he called for Absalom. Thus he came to the king and prostrated himself on his face to the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom. So after another 2 years, Absalom says, look, if I'm guilty, put me to death. If not, let me see my dad. My suspicion is that Absalom understands, is David going to put him to death? He's not willing to do that. Has Absalom done something worthy of being put to death? Absolutely. Are there two or three witnesses for that court case to happen? Yeah, all the king's sons. So we now have two sons who have sinned, and yet, here's the interesting thing. Amnon sinned by taking a woman that was not his. Had David done that? Yes. Now, Absalom had sinned, not with a woman, but by taking a man that he didn't like and working up a conspiracy to have him put to death. Has David done that? That's what he did with Uriah. So now he's got two sons who've committed sins that are awfully similar to what David's were. And so David's unwilling to put them to death for it. And so the consequences of this sin continue to just peel forward and roll forward more and more and more. There are always unintended consequences for sin. And that's what we're seeing with David. Now, is David forgiven by God? Yes, 100%. Absolutely. So if David died in the middle of all of this mess, where would he go? He would go to heaven. But the physical consequences of sin still exist here on earth. And I mention this over and over again because we don't want to confuse the two. When God forgives us of sin, that means your soul's clean. But it doesn't mean that all of a sudden the, you know, if you stole $10 million from people and you become a Christian and you realize that was wrong and you repent and you're, you know, you're baptized, you go to heaven. But that $10 million that you stole from people, do you think that's going to cause you any problems down here on earth? Of course it is. And that's what David's finding here, is that these things are rolling through his life. So Absalom is now, he's been in the city for 2 years, and now David has accepted him back, that he can now see him and dine with him and those sorts of things. You'd think things are going to get better now, right? So we've kind of gotten to the end of all these problems. We've everything's settled down, right? Except no. Anybody have anything on chapter 14? Okay. So then in chapter 15, what we're going to find is that Absalom is going to conspire to remove David. And he's going to do it using his good looks, his charm, the fact that he's praiseworthy by all the people. And what he's going to do is in chapter 15, it says, "It came about after this that Absalom provided for himself a chariot and horses and 50 men as runners before him." This probably doesn't mean a ton to us, but it's going to show up a couple of different times. Whenever somebody wants to be king, one of David's sons, they're going to do this. They're going to give themselves a chariot and people who run before him, because there's really only one other person in all the kingdom that has runners who go before him when he goes in the streets. Guess who it is? King. It's David. If you're the king, you have a chariot and you have horsemen and you have runners who go ahead and say, "The king's coming, the king's coming." Well, Absalom does this to give himself that same level of prestige. And then it says he would rise early and he'd stand beside the way to the gate. So as people come into the city looking to have their cases heard by the king, which the first place you would stop is in the gate. Not only is the gate into Jerusalem the physical entrance, but archaeology tells us that most cities had double walls, especially big cities, and Jerusalem's a pretty big city for that time period. And in that space between those double walls, when it wasn't wartime, that space was often used to set up where the elders of the city would sit to hear people's grievances and problems. So Absalom sets himself up there, and then whenever somebody comes in and says, "I'm here to see the king because I have some sort of case I want him to hear," Absalom will tell him in verse 3, "See, your claims are good and right, but no man listens to you on the part of the king. Moreover, Absalom would say, 'Oh, that one would appoint me judge in the land. Then every man who has any suit or cause could come to me, and I would give him justice.' And when a man came near to prostrate himself before him, he would put out his hand and take hold of him and kiss him. In this manner, Absalom dealt with all Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole away the hearts of the men of Israel." Absalom is a politician. You know, they would go to kiss his hand and he would embrace him like a brother. This is like you see politicians kissing babies and things like that. He'd do that. And he would say, "Oh, I think you've got a good case, but it's too bad nobody will... none of the king's servants will hear you. If I were a judge in the land, it'd be different. But you know, it is the way it is." And he's winning the people's hearts. He's swaying them over. And once that reaches a tipping point, he's going to then take and really attempt to usurp the kingdom. Anybody have any comments or questions? Okay, so that's where we'll stop for now. We'll pick up in verse 7 when Absalom actually enacts his attempt to take over the kingdom. And we'll start there next week.